Bach. I looked up to find Jamie leaning against a tree on the other side of the streamlet. The bold colours of his dress tartan and white linen sark stood out bright against the faded autumn foliage. Face and hands, though, made him look like some denizen of the wood, all bronze and auburn, with the wind stirring his hair so that the free ends danced like the scarlet maple leaves above. "Well, he's apparently impervious to cold and damp," I said, concluding my labours and discarding the final handful of soiled leaves. "Beyond that, well, I've not had much to do with male infants before, but isn't this rather precocious?" One corner of Jamie's mouth curled up as he peered at the prospect revealed under my hand. The tiny appendage stood up, stiff as my thumb, and roughly the same size. "Ah, no," he said. "I've seen many a wee lad in the raw. They all do that now and again." He shrugged, and the smile grew wider. "Now, whether it's only Scottish lads, I couldna be saying."
"A talent that improves with age, I dare say," I said dryly. I tossed the dirty clout across the streamlet, where it landed at his feet with a splat. "Get the pins and rinse that out, will you?"
His long, straight nose wrinkled slightly, but he knelt without demur and picked the filthy thing up gingerly between two fingers.
"Oh, so that's what you've done with your petticoat," he said.
I had opened the large pocket I wore slung at my waist and extracted a clean, folded rectangle of cloth. Not the unbleached linen of the clout he held, but a thick, soft, often washed wool flannel, dyed a pale red with the juice of currants. I shrugged, checked Jemmy for the prospect of fresh explosions, and popped him onto the new diaper. With three babies all in clouts, and the weather too damp to dry anything properly, we were rather short of clean bits. The bushes around the clearing where we had made our family camp were all festooned with flapping laundry, most of it still wet, owing to the inopportune weather.
"Here."
Jamie stretched across the foot-wide span of rock-strewn mortar to hand me the pins extracted from the old diaper. I took them, careful not to drop them in the stream. My fingers were stiff and chilly, but the pins were valuable. Bree had made them of heated wire, and Roger had carved the capped heads from wood in accordance with her drawings. Honest-to-goodness safety pins, if a bit larger and cruder than the modern version. The only real defect was the glue used to hold the wooden beads to the wire. Made from boiled milk and hoof parings, it wasn't entirely waterproof, and the heads had to be re-glued periodically. I folded the diaper snugly about Jemmy's loins and thrust a pin through the cloth, smiling at the sight of the wooden cap. Bree had taken one set and carved a small comical frog, each with a wide, toothless grin, onto each one.
"All right, froggy, here you go, then."
Diaper securely fastened, I sat down and boosted him into my lap, smoothing down his smock and attempting to rewrap his blanket.
"Where did Duncan go?" I asked. "Down to see the lieutenant?"
Jamie shook his head, bent over his task.
"I told him not to go yet. He was in Hillsborough during the troubles there. Best he should wait a bit. Then if Hayes should ask, he can swear honestly there's no man here who took part in the riots."
He looked up and smiled without humour.
"There won't be. Come nightfall."
I watched his hands, large and capable, wringing out the rinsed clout. The scars on his right hand were usually almost invisible, but they stood out now, ragged white lines against his cold, reddened skin. The whole business made me mildly uneasy, though there seemed no direct connection with us. For the most part, I could think of Governor Tryon with no more than a faint sense of edginess. He was, after all, safely tucked away in his nice new palace in New Bern, separated from our tiny settlement on Fraser's Ridge by 300 miles of coastal towns, inland plantations, pine forest, Piedmont, trackless mountains, and sheer howling wilderness.
with all the other things he had to worry about, such as the self-styled regulators who had terrorised Hillsborough and the corrupt sheriffs and judges who had provoked the terror, I hardly thought he would have time to spare a thought for us. I hope not. The uncomfortable fact remained that Jamie held title to a large grant of land in the North Carolina mountains as the gift of Governor Tryon, and Tryon, in turn, held one small but important fact tucked away in his vest pocket. Jamie was a Catholic, and royal grants of lands could be made only to Protestants by law. Given the tiny number of Catholics in the colony and the lack of organisation among them, the question of religion was rarely an issue. There were no Catholic churches, no resident Catholic priests. Father Donahue had made the arduous journey down from Baltimore at Jocasta's request. Jamie's aunt Jocasta and her late husband Hector Cameron had been influential among the Scottish community here for so long that no one would have thought of questioning their religious background, and I thought it likely that few of the Scots with whom we had been celebrating all week knew that we were Papists. They were, however, likely to notice quite soon. Bree and Roger, who had been hand-fasted for a year, were to be married by the priest this evening, along with two other Catholic couples from Bremerton, and with Jocasta and Duncan Innes.
"Archie Hayes," I said suddenly, "is he a Catholic?"
Jamie hung the wet clout from a nearby branch and shook water from his hands.
"I haven't asked him," he said, "but I shouldn't think so. That is, his father was not. I should be surprised if he was, and him an officer."
True. The disadvantages of Scottish birth, poverty, and being an ex-Jacobite were sufficiently staggering. Amazing enough that Hayes had overcome these to rise to his present position, without the additional burden of the taint of papistry. What was troubling me, though, was not the thought of Lieutenant Hayes and his men. It was Jamie. Outwardly, he was calm and assured as ever, with that faint smile always hiding in the corner of his mouth. But I knew him very well. I had seen the two stiff fingers of his right hand, maimed in an English prison, twitch against the side of his leg as he traded jokes and stories with Hayes the night before. Even now I could see the thin line that formed between his brows when he was troubled, and it wasn't concern over what he was doing. Was it simply worry over the proclamation? I couldn't see why that should be, given that none of our folk had been involved in the Hillsborough riots.
"A Presbyterian," he was saying.
He glanced over at me with a wry smile.
"Like wee Roger."
The memory that had niggled at me earlier dropped suddenly into place.
"You knew that," I said. "You knew Roger wasn't a Catholic. You saw him baptize that child in Snaketown when we
took him from the Indians." Too late. I saw the shadow across his face and bit my tongue.
"When we took Roger and left in his place Jamie's dearly loved nephew, Ian."
A shadow crossed his face momentarily, but he smiled, pushing away the thought of Ian.
I did," he said.
"But Bree..."
"She'd marry the lad if he were a Hottentot," Jamie interrupted. "Anyone can see that. And I canna say I'd object over much to wee Roger if he were a Hottentot," he added, rather to my surprise.
"You wouldn't?"
Jamie shrugged and stepped over the tiny creek to my side, wiping wet hands on the end of his plaid.
"He's a braw lad, and he's kind. He's taken the wean as his own and said no word to the lass about it. It's no more than a man should do, but not every man would."
I glanced down involuntarily at Jamie, curled up cosily in my arms. I tried not to think of it myself, but couldn't help now and then searching his bluntly amiable features for any trace that might reveal his true paternity. Brianna had been handfast with Roger, lain with him for one night, and then had been raped 2 days later by Stephen Bonnet. There was no way to tell for sure who the father had been,
and so far Jemmy gave no indication of resembling either man in the slightest. He was gnawing his fist at the moment with a ferocious scowl of concentration, and with his soft fuzz of red-gold plush, he looked like no one so much as Jamie himself.
So why all the insistence on having Roger vetted by a priest?
Well, they'll be married in any case, he said logically. I want the wee lad baptized a Catholic, though.
He laid a large hand gently on Jemmy's head, thumbs smoothing the tiny red brows.
So, if I made a bit of a fuss about Mackenzie, I thought they'd be pleased to agree about an Guillerou here, aye?
I laughed and pulled a fold of blanket up around Jemmy's ears. And I thought Brianna had you figured out.
So does she, he said with a grin.
He bent suddenly and kissed me. His mouth was soft and very warm. He tasted of bread and butter, and he smelled strongly of fresh leaves and unwashed mail, with just the faintest trace of effluvium of diaper.
Oh, that's nice, I said with approval. Do it again.
The wood around us was still, in the way of woods. No bird, no beast, just the sough of leaves above, and the rush of water underfoot. Constant movement, constant sound, and at the centre of it all, a perfect peace. There were a good many people on the mountain, and most of them not that far away. Yet just here, just now, we might have been alone on Jupiter. I opened my eyes and sighed, tasting honey. Jamie smiled at me and brushed a fallen yellow leaf from my hair. The baby lay in my arms, a heavy, warm weight, the centre of the universe. Neither of us spoke, not wishing to disturb the stillness. It was like being at the tip of a spinning top, I thought, a whirl of events and people going on all round, and a step in one direction or another would plunge us back into that spinning frenzy. But here, at the very centre, there was peace. I reached up and brushed a scatter of maple seeds from his shoulder. He seized my hand and brought it to his mouth with a sudden fierceness that startled me. And yet his lips were tender, the tip of his tongue warm on the fleshy mound at the base of my thumb. The Mount of Venus, it's called. Love's seat. He raised his head, and I felt the sudden chill on my hand where the ancient scar showed white as bone. A letter J, cut in the skin. His mark on me. He laid his hand against my face, and I pressed it there with my own, as though I could feel the faded C he bore on his own palm against the cold skin of my cheek. Neither of us spoke, but the pledge was made, as we had made it once before, in a place of sanctuary, our feet on a scrap of bedrock in the shifting sands of threatened war. It wasn't near, not yet. But I heard it coming, in the sound of drums and proclamation, saw it in the glint of steel, knew the fear of it in heart and bone when I looked in Jamie's eyes. The chill had gone, and hot blood throbbed in my hand as though to split the ancient scar and spill my heart's blood for him once again. It would come, and I couldn't stop it. But this time, I wouldn't leave him.
This ends Disc 1. The Fiery Cross, Disc 2.
I followed Jamie out of the trees, across a scrabble of rocks and sand and tufted grass, to the well-trampled trail that led upward to our campsite. I was counting in my head, readjusting the breakfast requirements yet again, in light of Jamie's revelation that he'd invited two more families to join us for the meal. "Robin McGilvery and Geordie Chisholm," he said, holding back a branch for me to pass.
"I thought we should make them welcome. They mean to come and settle on the ridge."
"Do they?" I said, ducking as the branch slapped back behind me. "When? And how many of them are there?" These were loaded questions, It was close to winter, much too close to count on building even the crudest cabin for shelter. Anyone who came to the mountains now would likely have to live in the big house with us, or crowd into one of the small settlers' cabins that dotted the ridge. Highlanders could, did, and would live 10 to a room when necessary. With my less strongly developed sense of English hospitality, I rather hoped it wouldn't be necessary.
6 McGilvrys and 8 Chisholms, Jamie said, smiling. The McGilvrys will come in the spring, though. Robin's a gunsmith. He'll have work in Cross Creek for the winter, and his family will bide with kin in Salem. His wife's German, until the weather warms.
Oh, that's good.
14 more for breakfast, then, plus me and Jamie, Roger and Bree, Masali and Fergus, Lizzie and her father, Abel McLennan, mustn't forget him, oh, and the soldier who'd rescued Germaine. That made 24.
I'll go and borrow some coffee and rice from my aunt, shall I?
Jamie had been reading the growing look of dismay on my features. He grinned and held out his arms for the baby.
Give me the laddie. We'll go visiting and leave your hands free for the cooking.
I watched them go with a small sense of relief. Alone, if only for a few moments. I drew a long, deep breath of damp air, becoming aware of the soft patter of the rain on my hood. I loved gatherings and social occasions, but was obliged to admit to myself that the strain of unrelieved company for days on end rather got on my nerves. After a week of visiting, gossip, daily medical clinics, and the small but constant crises that attend living rough with a large family group, I was ready to dig a small hole under a log and climb in, just for the sake of a quarter hour's solitude. Just at that moment, though, it looked as though I might be saved the effort. There were shouts, calls, and snatches of pipe music from higher up the mountain. Disturbed by the governor's proclamation, the gathering was re-establishing its normal rhythm, and everyone was going back to their family hearths, to the clearing where the competitions were held, to the livestock pens beyond the creek, or to the wagons set up to sell everything from ribbons and churns to powdered mortar and fresh, well, relatively fresh, lemons. No one needed me for the moment. It was going to be a very busy day, and this might be my only chance of solitude for a week or more. The trip back would take at least that long, moving slowly with a large party, including babies and wagons. Most of the new tenants had neither horses nor mules and would make the journey on foot. I needed a moment to myself to gather my strength and focus my mind. What focus I had, though, wasn't on the logistics of breakfasts or weddings, nor even on the impending surgery I was contemplating. I was looking farther forward, past the journey, longing for home. Fraser's Ridge was high in the western mountains, far beyond any town or even any established roads. Remote and isolated, we had few visitors. Few inhabitants, too, though the population of the ridge was growing. More than 30 families had come to take up homesteads on Jamie's granted land, under his sponsorship. Most of these were men he had known in prison, at Ardsmuir. I thought Chisholm and McGilvery must be ex-prisoners too. Jamie had put out a standing invitation for such men, and would hold to it, no matter the expense involved in helping them, or whether we could afford it. A raven flew silently past, slow and heavy, its feathers burdened by the rain. Ravens were birds of omen. I wondered whether this one meant us good or ill. Rare for any bird to fly in such weather. That must mean it was a special omen. I knocked the heel of my hand against my head, trying to smack the superstition out of it. Live with Highlanders long enough, and every damn rock and tree meant something. Perhaps it did, though. There were people all round me on the mountain. I knew that. And yet I felt quite alone, shielded by the rain and fog. The weather was still cold, but I wasn't. The blood thrummed near the surface of my skin, and I felt heat rise in my palms. I reached out a hand to the pine that stood by me, drops of water trembling on each needle, its bark black with wet. I breathed its scent and let the water touch my skin, cool as vapour. The rain fell in shushing stillness all around me, dampening my clothes till they clung to me softly, like clouds upon the mountain. Jamie had told me once that he must live on a mountain, and I knew now why this was so, though I could in no wise have put the notion into words. All my scattered thoughts receded as I listened for the voice of rocks and trees, and heard the bell of the mountain strike once, somewhere deep beneath my feet. I might have stood thus enchanted for some time, all thought of breakfast forgotten. But the voices of rocks and trees hushed and vanished with a clatter of feet on the nearby path.
"Mrs. Fraser!"
It was Archie Hayes himself, resplendent in bonnet and sword despite the wet. If he was surprised to see me standing by the path alone, he didn't show it, but inclined his head in courteous greeting. "Lieutenant," I bowed back, feeling my cheeks flush as though he had caught me in the midst of bathing.
"Will your husband be about, ma'am?" he asked, voice casual.
Despite my discomfiture, I felt a stab of wariness.
Young Corporal McNair had come to fetch Jamie, and failed. If the mountain had come to Mohammed now, the matter wasn't casual. Was Hayes intending to drag Jamie into some sort of witch hunt for regulators?
"I suppose so. I don't really know where he is," I said, consciously not looking up the hill to the spot where Jocasta's big tent showed its canvas peak among a stand of chestnut trees.
"Ah, I expect he'll be that busy," Hayes said comfortably. "A great deal to do for a man like himself, and this the last day of the gathering."
"Yes. I expect, yes." The conversation died, and I was left in a state of increasing discomfort, wondering how on earth I was to escape without inviting the lieutenant to breakfast. Even an Englishwoman couldn't get away with the rudeness of not offering food without exciting remark.
"Corporal McNair said you wanted to see Farquhar Campbell as well," I said, seizing the bull by the horns. "Perhaps Jamie's gone to talk with him. Mr. Campbell, I mean."
I waved helpfully toward the Campbell's family campsite, which lay on the far side of the slope, nearly a quarter mile from Jocasta's. Hayes blinked, drops running from his lashes down his cheeks.
"Aye," he said, "perhaps that's so."
He stood a moment longer, then tipped his cap to me.
"Good day to you, mum."
He turned away up the path, toward Jocasta's tent. I stood watching him go, all sense of peace destroyed. "Damn," I said under my breath, and set off to see about breakfast. Chapter 2. Loaves and Fishes. We had chosen a site well off the main path, but situated in a small rocky clearing with a good view of the wide creek bank below. Glancing downward through a scrim of holly bushes, I could see the flash of green and black tartans as the last of the soldiers dispersed. Archie Hayes encouraged his men to mingle with the people at the gathering, and most were only too glad to obey. I wasn't sure whether this policy of Archie's was dictated by guile, penury, or simply humanitarianism. Many of his soldiers were young, separated from home and family. They were glad of the chance to hear Scottish voices again, to be welcomed at a homely fireside, offered brose and porridge, and to bask in the momentary warmth of familiarity. As I came out of the trees, I saw that Massali and Lizzie were making a small fuss of the bashful young soldier who had fished Jermaine out of the creek. Fergus stood close to the fire, wisps of steam rising from his wet garments, muttering in French as he rubbed Jermaine's head briskly with a towel, one-handed. His hook was braced against the little boy's shoulder to keep him steady, and the blonde head wobbled back and forth, Germaine's face quite tranquil, in complete disregard of his father's scolding. Neither Roger nor Brianna were anywhere in sight. But I was rather alarmed to see Abel McLennan sitting on the far side of the clearing, nibbling a bit of toasted bread on a stick. Jamie was already back with the borrowed supplies, which he was unpacking on the ground next to the fire. He was frowning to himself, but the frown melted into a smile at the sight of me.
"Oh, there you are, Sassenach," he said, rising to his feet. "What kept you?"
"Oh, I met an acquaintance on the trail," I said, with a significant look toward the young soldier. It was evidently not significant enough, since Jamie knitted his brows in puzzlement. "The lieutenant is looking for you," I hissed, leaning close to him.
"Well, I ken that, Sassenach," he said, in a normal tone of voice. "You'll find me soon enough."
"Yes, but..."
I cleared my throat and raised my brows, glancing pointedly from Abel McLennan to the young soldier. Jamie's notions of hospitality wouldn't countenance having his guests dragged away from under his roof tree, and I would have supposed that the same principle applied to his campfire as well. The young soldier might find it awkward to arrest McLennan, but I was sure the lieutenant would have no such hesitation. Jamie looked rather amused. Raising his own brows, he took my arm and led me over to the young man.
"My dear," he said formally, "may I present Private Andrew Ogilvy, late of the village of Kilburnie?" "Private Ogilvy? My wife."
Private Ogilvy, a ruddy-faced boy with dark curly hair, blushed and bowed.
"Your servant, mum."
Jamie squeezed my arm lightly.
"Private Ogilvy was just telling me that the regiment is bound for Portsmouth, in Virginia, there to take ship for Scotland. You'll be glad to see home, I expect, lad."
"Oh, aye, sir," the lad said fervently. "The regiment will disband in Aberdeen, and then I'm off home so fast as my legs will carry me."
"The regiment is disbanding?"
Fergus asked, coming to join the conversation, a towel draped round his neck and Germaine in his arms.
"Aye, sir, with the Frenchies settled, begging your pardon, sir, and the Indians safe, there's naught for us to do here, and the Crown will not pay us to sit at home,"
the lad said ruefully.
"Peace may be a good thing, all in all, and I'm glad of it, surely. But there's no denying as it's hard on a soldier."
"Almost as hard as war, aye?"
Jamie said dryly. The boy flushed darkly. Young as he was, he couldn't have seen much in the way of actual fighting. The 7 years' war had been over for nearly 10 years, at which time Private Ogilvy would likely still have been a barefoot lad in Kilburnie. Ignoring the boy's embarrassment, Jamie turned to me.
"The lad tells me," he added, "that the 67th is the last regiment left in the colonies."
"The last Highland regiment?" I asked.
"No, mum, the last of the Crown's regular troops. There are the garrisons here and there, I suppose, but all of the standing regiments have been recalled to England or Scotland. We're the last, and behind our time too. We meant to sail from Charleston, but things went aglay there, and so we're bound for Portsmouth now, so fast as we can make speed. It's late in the year, but the lieutenant's had word of a ship that may risk passage to take us. If not..."
He shrugged, glumly philosophic.
"Then we shall winter in Portsmouth, I suppose, and make shift as we can."
"So England means to leave us unprotected?" Massali looked rather shocked at the thought.
"Oh, I wouldn't think there's any great danger, mum," Private Ogilvy assured her. "We've dealt with the Frenchies for good and all, and the Indians will not be up to much without the frogs to stir them up. Everything's been quite peaceful for a good time now, and doubtless it'll stay so."
I made a small noise in the back of my throat, and Jamie squeezed my elbow lightly.
"Have you not thought, perhaps, to stay then?"
Lizzie had been peeling and grating potatoes while listening to this. She put down the bowl of glistening white shreds by the fire and began to smear grease on the griddle.
"Stay in the colonies, I mean. There's plenty of land still to be had. To the west?"
"Oh."
Private Ogilvy glanced down at her. Her white kerch modestly bent over her work, and his colour deepened again.
"Well, I will say I've had worse prospects, miss. But I'm bound to go with my regiment, I'm afraid."
Lizzie picked up two eggs and cracked them neatly against the side of the bowl. Her own face, usually pale as whey, bore a faint pink echo of the private's rich blush.
"Ah, well, it's a great pity that you should go away so soon," she said.
Her pale blonde lashes swept down against her cheeks.
"Still, we'll not send you away on an empty stomach."
Private Ogilvy went slightly pinker round the ears.
"That's very kind of you, miss. Very kind indeed."
Lizzie glanced up shyly and blushed more deeply. Jamie coughed gently and excused himself, leading me away from the fire.
"Christ," he said in an undertone, bending down so I could hear him. "And she's been a woman less than a full day, too. Have you been given a lesson, Sassenach? Or are women just born with it?"
"Natural talent, I expect," I said circumspectly. The unexpected advent of Lizzie's monarchy after supper last night had in fact been the straw that broke the camel's back with regard to clean clouts and the precipitating event that had caused me to sacrifice my petticoat. Lizzie naturally had no menstrual cloths with her, and I didn't want to oblige her to share the children's diapers.
"Mm-hmm. I suppose I'd best begin looking for a husband for her, then," Jamie said in resignation.
"A husband? Why, she's scarcely 15.
"Aye, so?"
He glanced at Massali, who was rubbing Fergus's dark hair dry with the towel, and then back at Lizzie and her soldier, and raised a cynical brow at me.
"Aye, so yourself," I said, a little crossly. "All right. Massali had been only 15 when she married Fergus. That didn't mean..." "The point being," Jamie went on, dismissing Lizzie for the moment, "that the regiment leaves for Portsmouth tomorrow. They haven't got either time nor disposition to trouble with this business in Hillsborough. That's Tryon's concern."
"But what Hayes said..."
"Oh, if anyone tells him anything, I'm sure he'll send the depositions along to New Bern. But as for himself, I imagine he'd not much care if the regulator set fire to the governor's palace, so long as it doesn't delay his sailing."
I heaved a deep sigh, reassured. If Jamie was right, the last thing Hayes would do was to take prisoners, no matter what the evidence to hand. McLennan was safe then.
"But what do you suppose Hayes wants with you and the others, then?"
I asked, bending to rummage in one of the wicker hampers for another loaf of bread. "He is hunting you, in person." Jamie glanced back over his shoulder, as though expecting the lieutenant to appear at any moment through the holly bushes. As the screen of prickly green remained intact, he turned back to me, frowning slightly.
"But then again," he said, shaking his head, "but it's not to do with this business of Tryon's." "If it was that, he might have told me last night. For that matter, if he cared himself about the matter, he would have told me last night," he added. "No, Sassenach, depend upon it, the rioters are no more than a matter of duty to wee Archie Hayes." "As for what he wants with me..."
He leaned over my shoulder to swipe a finger round the top of the honey pot.
"I didn't mean to trouble about it until I must. I've 3 kegs of whisky left, and I mean to turn them into a ploughshare, a scythe blade, 3 axe heads, 10 pounds of sugar, a horse, and an astrolabe before this evening. Which is a conjuring trick that might take some attention, eh?"
He drew the sticky tip of his finger gently across my lips, then turned my head toward him and bent to kiss me.
"An astrolabe," I said, tasting honey.
I kissed him back.
"Whatever for?"
"And then I want to go home," he whispered, ignoring the question.
His forehead was pressed against mine, and his eyes very blue.
"I want to take you to bed.
in my bed. And I mean to spend the rest of the day thinking what to do with you once I've got you there. So we Archie can just go and play at marbles with his bollocks, aye?
An excellent thought, I whispered back.
Care to tell him that yourself?
My eye had caught the flash of a green and black tartan on the other side of the clearing, but when Jamie straightened up and whirled round, I saw that the visitor was in fact not Lieutenant Hayes, but rather John Quincy Myers, who was sporting a soldier's plaid wrapped round his waist, the ends fluttering gaily in the breeze. This added a further touch of colour to Myers's already striking sartorial splendour. Extremely tall, and decorated from the top down with a slouch hat stuck through with several needles and a turkey quill, two ragged pheasant feathers knotted into his long black hair, a vest of dyed porcupine quills worn over a beaded shirt, his usual breech clout, and leggings wrapped with strings of small bells. The mountain man was hard to miss.
"Friend James!" John Quincy smiled broadly at sight of Jamie and hastened forward, hand extended and bells chiming. "Thought I should find you at your breakfast."
Jamie blinked slightly at this vision, but gamely returned the mountain man's encompassing handshake.
"Aye, John. Will you join us?"
Yes, I chimed in, with a surreptitious look into the food hamper.
"Please do."
John Quincy bowed ceremoniously to me, sweeping off his hat.
"Your servant, ma'am, and I'm much obliged. Maybe later. Right now I come to fetch away Mr. Fraser, though. He's wanted, urgent-like."
"By whom?" Jamie asked warily.
"Robbie McGilvery, he says his name is. You know the man?"
"Aye, I do."
Whatever Jamie knew about McGilvery, it was causing him to delve into the small chest where he kept his pistols.
"What's the trouble?" "Well..."
John Quincy scratched meditatively at his bushy black beard.
"'Twas his wife asked me to come find you, and she don't speak what you'd call right good English. So maybe as I've muddled the account of it a bit. But what I think she said to me was as how there was a thief-taker who'd grabbed hold of her son, saying as how the boy was one of the ruffians who broke up Hillsborough, and meaning to take him to the jail in New Bern. Only Robbie, he says no one's taken a son of his anywhere. And well, after that, the poor woman got right flustered, and I couldn't make out but one word to the dozen. But I do believe Robbie would appreciate it if you'd come by and lend a hand with the proceedings."
Jamie grabbed Roger's blood-stained green coat, which was hung on a bush waiting to be cleaned. Shrugging into it, he thrust the newly loaded pistol through his belt.
"Where?"
he said. Myers gestured economically with one large thumb and pushed off into the holly bushes, Jamie at his heels. Fergus, who had been listening to this exchange, Jermaine in his arms, set the boy down at Massali's feet.
"I must go help Grandpère," he told Jermaine.
He picked up a stick of firewood and put it into the little boy's hands.
"You stay. Protect Maman and little Joan from bad people."
"Oui, papa."
Jermaine scowled fiercely under his blonde fringe and took a firm grip on his stick, settling himself to defend the camp. Massali, McLennan, Lizzie, and Private Ogilvy had been watching the byplay with rather glazed looks. As Fergus picked up another length of firewood and plunged purposefully into the holly bushes, Private Ogilvy came to life, stirring uneasily.
He said, "perhaps I should go for my sergeant, do you think, ma'am? If there's like to be any trouble."
"No, no," I said hurriedly. The last thing we needed was for Archie Hayes and his regiment to show up en masse. This struck me as the sort of situation which would benefit strongly from being kept unofficial.
"I'm sure everything will be quite all right. It's sure to be nothing but a misunderstanding. Mr. Fraser will sort it directly, never fear."
Even as I spoke, I was sidling round the fire toward the spot where my medical supplies lay, sheltered from the drizzle under a sheet of canvas. Reaching under the edge, I grabbed my small emergency kit. Lizzie, why don't you give Private Ogilvy some of the strawberry preserves for his toast? And Mr. McLennan would like a bit of honey in his coffee, I'm sure. Do excuse me, won't you, Mr. McLennan? I must just go and, Smiling inanely, I sidled through the holly leaves. As the branches swished and crackled behind me, I paused to take my bearings. A faint chime of bells reached me on the rainy wind. I turned toward the sound and broke into a run. It was some way. I was out of breath and sweating from the exercise by the time I caught them up near the competition field. Things were just getting underway. I could hear the buzz of talk from the crowd of men gathering, but no shouts of encouragement or howls of disappointment as yet. A few brawny specimens stamped to and fro, stripped to the waist, and swinging their arms to limber up, the local strongmen of various settlements. The drizzle had started up again. The wetness gleamed on curving shoulders and plastered swirls of dark body hair flat against the pale skins of chests and forearms. I had no time to appreciate the spectacle, though. John Quincy threaded his way adroitly through the knots of spectators and competitors, waving cordially to this and that acquaintance as we passed. On the far side of the crowd, a small man detached himself from the mass and came hurrying to meet us.
"MacDhu, you've come, then? That's good."
"Nay bother, Robbie," Jamie assured him.
"What's to do, then?"
McGilvery, who looked distinctly harried, glanced at the strongmen and their supporters, then jerked his head toward the nearby trees. We followed him, unnoticed by the crowd gathering round two large stones wrapped with rope, which, I assumed, some of the strongmen present were about to prove their prowess by lifting.
"It's your son, is it, Rob?"
Jamie asked, dodging a water-filled pine branch.
"Aye,"
Robbie answered.
"Or it was."
That sounded sinister. I saw Jamie's hand brush the butt of his pistol. Mine went to my medical kit.
"What's happened?" I asked. "Is he hurt?"
"Not him,"
McGilvery replied cryptically, and ducked a head beneath a drooping chestnut bough hung with scarlet creeper. Just beyond was a small open space, not really big enough to be called a clearing, tufted with dead grass and studded with pine saplings. As Fergus and I ducked under the creeper after Jamie, a large woman in homespun whirled toward us, shoulders hunching as she raised the broken tree limb she clutched in one hand. She saw McGilvery, though, and relaxed fractionally.
"Where is thus?"
she asked suspiciously, eyeing us. Then John Quincy appeared from under the creeper, and she lowered her club, her solidly handsome features relaxing further.
"Ah, Myers, you brung me then Jamie, oder?"
She cast me a curious look, but was too busy glancing between Fergus and Jamie to inspect me closely.
"Aye, love, this is Jamie Roy, Seamus MacDhu."
McGilvery hastened to take credit for Jamie's appearance, putting a respectful hand on his sleeve.
"And my wife, Uta MacDhu. And MacDhu's son," he added, waving vaguely at Fergus.
Uta McGilvery looked like a Valkyrie on a starchy diet, tall, very blonde, and broadly powerful.
"Your servant, ma'am," Jamie said, bowing.
"Madame,"
Fergus echoed, making her a courtly leg. Mrs. McGilvery dropped them a low curtsy in return, eyes fixed on the prominent bloodstain streaking the front of Jamie's, or rather, Roger's coat.
"Mein Herr,"
she murmured, looking impressed. She turned and beckoned to a young man of 17 or 18 who had been lurking in the background. He bore such a marked resemblance to his small, wiry, dark-haired father that his identity could scarcely be in doubt.
"Manfred," his mother announced proudly, "mein laddie."
Jamie inclined his head in grave acknowledgement.
"Mr. McGilvery?"
Your servant, sir."
The boy sounded rather dubious about it, but put out his hand to be shaken.
"A pleasure to meet your acquaintance, sir,"
Jamie assured him, shaking it. The courtesy is duly observed. He looked briefly round at the quiet surroundings, raising one eyebrow.
I had heard that you were suffering some inconvenience with regard to a thief-taker. Do I take it that the matter has been resolved?
He glanced in question from McGilvery Jr. to McGilvery Sr.
The three McGilvereys exchanged assorted glances among themselves. Robin McGilvery gave an apologetic cough.
Well, not to say resolved quite, McDo. That is to say...
He trailed off, the harried look returning to his eyes.
Mrs. McGilvery gave him a stern look, then turned to Jamie.
Ist kein bother, she told him. Ich have den wee ball of shite safe foot. But only we want to know how we best den corpus hide.
The body? I said, rather faintly.
Even Jamie looked a bit disturbed at that.
You've killed him, Rob.
Me?
McGilvery looked shocked.
Christ's sake, McDo, what you take me for?
Jamie raised the eyebrow again. Evidently the thought of McGilvery committing violence was scarcely far-fetched. McGilvery had the grace to look abashed.
Aye. Well, I suppose I might have. And I did. Well, but McDo, that business at Ardsmuir was all long ago and done with, aye?
Aye, Jamie said. It was.
What about this business with the thief-taker, though? Where is he?
I heard a muffled giggle behind me and swung round to see that the rest of the family McGilvery, silent till now, was nonetheless present. Three teenaged girls sat in a row on a dead log behind a screen of saplings, all immaculately attired in clean white caps and aprons, only slightly wilted with the rain.
"Mine lasses,"
Mrs. McGilvery announced with a wave in their direction, unnecessarily, since all three of the girls looked like smaller versions of herself. Hilda, Inga, und Senga. Fergus bowed elegantly to the three.
Enchanté, mesdemoiselles.
The girls giggled and bobbed their heads in response, but without rising, which struck me as odd. Then I noticed some disturbance taking place under the skirt of the oldest girl, a sort of heaving flutter, accompanied by a muffled grunt. Hilda swung her heel sharply into whatever it was, all the time smiling brightly at me. There was another grunt, much louder this time, from under the skirt, which caused Jamie to start and turn in her direction. Still smiling brightly, Hilda bent and delicately picked up the edge of her skirt, under which I could see a frantic face, bisected by a dark strip of cloth tied round his mouth.
"That's him," said Robbie, sharing his wife's talent for stating the obvious.
"I see."
Jamie's fingers twitched slightly against the side of his kilt.
Perhaps we could have him out then.
Robbie motioned to the girls, who all stood up together and stepped aside, revealing a small man who lay against the base of the dead log, bound hand and foot with an assortment of what looked like women's stockings and gagged with someone's kerchief. He was wet, muddy, and slightly battered round the edges. Myers bent and hoisted the man to his feet, holding him by the collar.
"Well, he ain't much to look at,"
the mountain man said, critically squinting at the man as though evaluating a substandard beaver skin.
"I guess thief-taking don't pay so well as you might think."
The man was, in fact, skinny and rather ragged, as well as dishevelled, furious, and frightened. Uta sniffed contemptuously.
"Zucker," she said,
and spat neatly on the thief-taker's boots. Then she turned to Jamie, full of charm.
"So, mein Herr, how are we to kill him best?"
The thief-taker's eyes bulged and he writhed in Maya's grip. He bucked and twisted, making frantic gargling noises behind the gag. Jamie looked him over, rubbing a knuckle across his mouth, then glanced at Robbie, who gave a slight shrug, with an apologetic glance at his wife. Jamie cleared his throat.
You had something in mind, perhaps, ma'am?
Uta beamed at this evidence of sympathy with her intentions and drew a long dagger from her belt.
"I thought maybe to butcher wern Schwein, ja? But see."
She poked the thief-taker gingerly between the ribs. He yelped behind the gag,
and a small spot of blood bloomed on his ragged shirt.
"Too much blood," she explained, with a moo of disappointment.
She waved at the screen of trees, behind which the stone lifting seemed to be proceeding well.
"Die Leute will schmell."
"Schmell?"
I glanced at Jamie, thinking this some unfamiliar German expression. He coughed and brushed a hand under his nose.
"Oh, smell," I said, enlightened.
Yes, I think they might." "I dinna suppose we'd better shoot him then," Jamie said thoughtfully. "If you're wanting to avoid attention, I mean."
"I say we break his neck,"
Robbie McGilvery said, squinting judiciously at the trussed thief-taker.
"That's easy enough."
"You think?"
Fergus squinted in concentration.
"I say a knife. If you stab in the right spot, the blood is not so much. The kidney, just beneath the ribs in back, eh?"
The captive appeared to take exception to these suggestions, judging from the urgent sounds proceeding from behind the gag, and Jamie rubbed his chin dubiously.
"Well, that's no very difficult," he agreed. "Or strangle him. But he will lose his bowels. If it were to be a question of the smell, even crushing his skull. But tell me, Robbie, how does the man come to be here?"
"Eh?"
Robbie looked blank.
"You're no camped nearby."
Jamie waved a hand briefly at the tiny clearing, making his meaning clear. There was no trace of Hearthfire. In fact, no one had camped on this side of the creek. And yet all the McGilvrys were here.
"Oh, no,"
Robbie said, comprehension blossoming on his spare features. "Nay, we're camped some distance up.
Only we came to have a wee kick at the heavies."
He jerked his head toward the competition field.
"And the frigging vulture spied out Freddy and took hold of him so as to drag him off."
He cast an unfriendly look at the thief-taker, and I saw that a coil of rope dangled snake-like from the man's belt. A pair of iron manacles lay on the ground nearby, the dark metal already laced with orange rust from the damp.
"We saw him grab a hold of brother," Hilda put in at this point. "So we grabbed a hold of him and pushed him through here where nobody could see. When he said he meant to take brother away to the sheriff, me and my sisters knocked him down and sat on him, and Mama kicked him a few times."
Uta patted her daughter fondly on one sturdy shoulder.
"They are good, strong mädchen, meine lassies," she told Jamie. "We come see here die Wettkämpfer. Maybe choose husband for Inga or Senga. Hilda had einen Mann already promised,"
she added with an air of satisfaction. She looked Jamie over frankly, her eye dwelling approvingly on his height, the breadth of his shoulders, and the general prosperity of his appearance.
"He is fine big, your man," she said to me. "You have sons, maybe?"
"No, I'm afraid not," I said apologetically. "Fergus is married to my husband's daughter," I added, seeing her gaze shift appraisingly to Fergus.
The thief-taker appeared to feel that the subject was drifting somewhat afield, and summoned attention back to himself with an indignant squeal behind his gag. His face, which had gone pale at the discussion of his theoretical demise, had grown quite red again, and his hair was matted down across his forehead in spikes.
"Why,"
Jamie said, noticing,
"perhaps we should let the gentleman have a word."
Robbie narrowed his eyes at this, but reluctantly nodded. The competitions had got well underway by now, and there was a considerable racket emanating from the field. No one would notice the odd shout over here.
"Don't let him kill me, sir. You know it ain't right."
Hoarse from his ordeal, the man fixed his appeal on Jamie as soon as the gag was removed.
"I'm only doing as I ought, delivering a criminal to justice." "Ha!"
all the McGilvrys said at once. Unanimous as their sentiment appeared to be, the expression of it immediately disintegrated into a confusion of expletives, opinions, and a random volley of kicks aimed at the gentleman's shins by Inga and Senga.
"Stop that,"
Jamie said, raising his voice enough to be heard over the uproar. As this had no result, he grabbed McGilvery Jr. by the scruff of the neck and roared, "Hoo!" at the top of his lungs,
which startled them into momentary silence, with guilty looks over their shoulders in the direction of the competition field.
"Now then," Jamie said firmly, "Myers, bring the gentleman, if you will. Rob, Fergus, come along with you. Bitte, madam."
He bowed to Mrs. McGilvery, who blinked at him, but then nodded in slow acquiescence.
Jamie rolled an eye at me, then, still holding Manfred by the neck, he marched the male contingent off toward the creek, leaving me in charge of the ladies.
"Your man, he will save my son?"
Uta turned to me, fair brows knitted in concern.
"He'll try."
I glanced at the girls who were huddled together behind their mother.
"Do you know whether your brother was at Hillsborough?"
The girls looked at one another and silently elected Inga to speak.
"Well, yeah, he was then," she said, a little defiantly. "But he wasn't rioting. Not a bit of it. He'd only gone for to have a bit of harness mended and was caught up in the mob."
I caught a quick glance exchanged between Hilda and Sanger and deduced that this was perhaps not the entire story. Still, it wasn't my place to judge, thank goodness. Mrs. McGilvery's eyes were fixed on the men who stood murmuring together some distance away. The thief-taker had been untied, save for his hands, which remained bound. He stood with his back against a tree, looking like a cornered rat, eye teeth showing in a snarl of defiance. Jamie and Myers were both looming over him, while Fergus stood by, frowning attentively, his chin propped on his hook. Rob McGilvery had taken out a knife, with which he was contemplatively flicking small chips of wood from a pine twig, glancing now and then at the thief-taker with an air of dark intent. "I'm sure Jamie will be able to, do something," I said, privately hoping that the something wouldn't involve too much violence. The unwelcome thought occurred to me that the diminutive thief-taker would probably fit tidily in one of the empty food hampers.
"Good,"
Uta McGilvery nodded slowly, still watching.
"Better that I do not kill him."
Her eyes turned suddenly back to me, light blue and very bright.
"But I will do it, if I must."
I believed her.
"I see," I said carefully.
"But I do beg your pardon, but even if that man took your son, could you not go to the sheriff too and explain?" More glances among the girls. This time it was Hilda who spoke.
"Nein, ma'am. See, it wouldna have been so bad had the thief-taker come on us at the camp. But down here..."
She widened her eyes, nodding toward the competition field, where a muffled thud and a roar of approval marked some successful effort. The difficulty, apparently, was Hilda's fiancé, one Davy Morrison from Hunter's Point. Mr. Morrison was a farmer of some substance, and a man of worth, as well as an athlete skilled in the arcana of stone-throwing and caber-tossing. He had family, too. Parents, uncles, aunts, cousins, all of the most upright character, and, I gathered, rather judgmental attitudes. Had Manfred been taken by a thief-taker in front of such a crowd, filled with Davy Morrison's relations, word would have spread at the speed of light, and the scandal would result in the prompt rupture of Hilda's engagement, a prospect that clearly perturbed Uta McGilvery much more than the notion of cutting the thief-taker's throat.
"Bad to I kill him and someone see," she said frankly, waving at the thin scrim of trees shielding us from the competition field. "The Morrisons would not like."
"I suppose they might not," I murmured, wondering whether Davy Morrison had any idea what he was getting into. "But you..."
"I will have mine lassies well wed," she said firmly,
nodding several times in reinforcement.
"I find good men. Frissy, fine big men, mit land, mit money."
She put an arm round Sanger's shoulders and hugged her tight.
"Nicht wahr, Liebchen?"
"Ja, Mama,"
Sanger murmured, and laid her neat-capped head affectionately on Mrs. McGilvery's broad bosom. Something was happening on the men's side of things, The thief-taker's hands had been untied, and he stood rubbing his wrists, no longer scowling, but listening to whatever Jamie was saying with an expression of wariness. He glanced at us, then at Robin McGilvery, who said something to him, and nodded emphatically. The thief-taker's jaw worked as though he were chewing over an idea.